And as you have your Bibles this morning, I invite you to turn with me to the Gospel of John, the 10th chapter. I want us to focus on verse 27, but for purposes of context, let's begin reading with the 22nd verse, where John tells us, "Then came the feast of dedication at Jerusalem, and it was winter, and Jesus was in the temple area walking in Solomon's colonnade. The Jews gathered around Jesus, saying, 'How long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly.' Jesus answered, 'I did tell you, but you do not believe. The miracles I do in my Father's name speak for me, but you do not believe because you are not my sheep. My sheep listen to my voice. I know them, and they follow me.'" May God add his blessings to this, the reading of his word. For those of us who have grown up in the South, who have understood the importance of what it means to speak of being raised right, one of the things that get drilled into us from our early years, from the time when we are being formed, are the rules of etiquette. You remember growing up being taught how important it is when someone does something for you, when someone blesses you, gives you a gift, what are you expected to do? You are expected to write them a thank you note. That's drilled into us from an early age. Or when you are speaking to your elders, how do you speak to them? You say, "Yes, sir," and "No, sir." "Yes, ma'am," and "No, ma'am." When you are in a crowded place and you are sitting and someone who is advanced in age comes into the room, you are taught from an early age to get up, and to let them have your seat. You know, all of these types of behaviors really are just poured into us from a very early age so that they become second nature. I'm 63 years old. I'm still writing thank you notes. I'm still saying yes, sir, and no, sir, and yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. I'm still getting up to let others have my seat. You are as well, because of how you have learned these expectations, these rules of etiquette, so that when opportunities arise for you to give expression to them, you are compelled to do so. You are constrained to express them. But as life evolves, don't you think, wouldn't you agree that the rules of etiquette also should be evolving and developing? I'm not suggesting that we tell our children that they don't have to write thank you notes anymore, or say yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. Get up, give their seat to someone advanced in age. I'm not suggesting that at all. But what I am suggesting is that as new circumstances present themselves to us, as there are new technologies that come our way, I firmly believe that there should be rules of etiquette that apply to these new circumstances and new technologies. And in particular, I'm thinking about the cell phone. Now, before I quit preaching and go to meddling, Have you ever been fubbed? This is your pop culture lesson for the day. There's a new term out there. Fubbing, which sounds an awful lot like snubbing, which is where the term comes from. If you are fubbed, that means someone has snubbed you through the use of their cell phone. Who among us has not been fubbed a time or two? I remember when cell phones first came on the scene in my previous church. There were more lobbyists in the community per capita than any other place on the planet. And there were a good number of lobbyists who were members of the congregation that I served. And so on many occasions, I would be with them at some restaurant when their phone would ring, their cell phone would ring, and they'd just interrupt the conversation to take the call. And it would happen again and again and again and again. And at first, I didn't know how to handle it. You know, what do you do? What do you say? Even when there's the excuse me, you just sort of accept the fact that someone who is calling them is more important than you. That's what it means to be fubbed. Whoever is calling the party that you're with is more important than you. It's more important than your concerns. And so I just kind of made it a general rule. When I was with someone at a restaurant and my cell phone rang, I wouldn't take it. And I still won't, not to this day, with the following exceptions. If it's my wife, Judy, I'm taking that call. You're being fubbed. If it's one of our two children calling, I'm taking that call because, as those of you who have children know, they don't call on cell phones. They text. So if it's a call, it's some kind of emergency. If the church calls, I'm taking that call for this reason. They know that I am at a lunch engagement. They know that my preference is don't call me unless it's an emergency. So if the church calls while I'm having lunch with you, it's an emergency and I am compelled to take that call. You understand from your own experience that there are certain calls that you feel some constraint to take, regardless of the situation, because of the parties who are calling you. They are so important. You cannot disregard their call. You have your list. You have your list. So I ask you this morning, where does Jesus fall on your list? When Jesus calls, do you feel a compulsion, a constraint to take his call? Or is the call of Jesus one that you too easily ignore and sometimes reject? Now, those are questions that really are posed by the text that is before us this morning from John's Gospel, the 10th chapter, where Jesus has just explained to those religious leaders who have approached him about his agenda in ministry. "I've come," Jesus said, "in order that they might have life and might have it more abundantly." Now John tells us the feast of dedication has come around, a celebration in Jerusalem that, quite frankly, was a relatively recent feast for the Jews in Jesus' day. We're all familiar with the great feast from the Old Testament. Passover and Pentecost and Tabernacles, those are the festival occasions where all of God's people were expected to gather. This feast of dedication, you don't find it anywhere in your Old Testament. It marks a revolution that took place during the time between the Testaments. The Syrians were in control of Jerusalem. They had desecrated the temple. They had offered sacrifices on the altar to the Greek god Zeus. And a band of Jewish revolutionaries, the Maccabeans, led a revolt against the Syrians and displaced them and took back again the temple and reconsecrated the sanctuary and the altar and dedicated it afresh and anew by offering a sacrifice. Our Jewish friends still celebrate it today. They call it Hanukkah. Hanukkah, the festival of lights, which is a reminder to them of the courage and the bravery of their forebears in taking back the temple from the pagan rulers and rededicating it to the worship of God. Now that setting is very important to this story. And I dare say you may never have heard that explanation. Oh, the Feast of Dedication. Well, that must be some significant feast for the Jewish people. Indeed it was, and now you understand why. So, when this feast came around, now there was, in Jesus' day, another pagan presence in Jerusalem, the Romans. We see the shadow of Rome throughout the Gospel. And we see as well how the Jewish people, especially the religious leaders, were anticipating the time when God would raise up another revolutionary figure who would rid the city of the Romans and reestablish control of Jerusalem to God's people, the Jews, as God had ordained since the day of David. Another Davidic ruler, they called him the Messiah, the Christ. So that now in this story, John tells us that these religious leaders have gathered around Jesus. You picture the sight. It's not just, well, they've gathered to hear what Jesus had to say. They've surrounded him. Their intent is to pressure Jesus. About what? Tell us plainly, they say to Jesus. I mean, they're insisting that Jesus meet their expectations. They demand an answer from Jesus. Tell us plainly if you are the Christ. Because when you look at the 10th chapter, Jesus has been speaking about shepherds and gates and doors, and it's all just too figurative. And even though Ezekiel long ago in the 34th chapter talks about the day coming when God would raise up another shepherd for his people, that just goes over the religious leader's head. They don't want to hear any more metaphor. Tell us plainly. How long, they say, are you going to keep us in suspense? The Greek language is very active here. It's a terrific word picture. How long are you going to suck the life out from us? You're driving us crazy. Are you or are you not the Christ? And notice how Jesus responds. First he said, I have been telling you and showing you very plainly the miracles that I do. In the Gospel of John, there are 7 signs that are prominent in John's Gospel. You know this from Sunday school. 7 signs that manifest how Jesus fulfills messianic prophecies. 6 of the 7 signs have already occurred prior to this controversy. The only one left is the raising of Lazarus from the dead, which comes in the 11th chapter, the next chapter. That's the last of the 7 signs. But the 3 about which Jesus is speaking, very specifically, the healing of the paralytic at Bethesda in the 5th chapter of John's Gospel, the feeding of the 5,000, which occurs in all the Gospels. It's the only miracle that occurs in all 4 Gospels. That happens in the 6th chapter of John's Gospel. And then in the 9th chapter, there is the healing of the man who was born blind. 3 powerful expressions of how God is at work through Jesus to bring God's redemptive purposes to pass. And so Jesus says, you do not listen to me. You do not believe because you are not my sheep. My sheep, Jesus says. My sheep hear my voice. My sheep hear my voice. And I know them. And what do? They follow me. My sheep follow me. It's not that Jesus hasn't been speaking to these religious leaders. It's that they haven't been listening, because what Jesus has been saying and what Jesus has been doing has not lined up with their expectations, and so they have rejected the call of Jesus. They have not put their faith in him. True disciples hear the voice of Jesus very clearly in all circumstances, in all situations, and not only do true disciples hear the voice of Jesus calling, more importantly, they heed his voice. They follow his instruction. Whatever it takes, whatever the cost, whatever the sacrifice, true disciples not only hear, they heed. So that if someone says, I am a disciple of Jesus, I have heard his voice, but their lives do not reflect obedience to his word, they are, according to Jesus, not truly his disciples, because heeding goes with hearing. Hearing and heeding are 2 sides of the same coin. Disciples of Jesus feel this constraint to follow him. How is it with you in your own life? Do your words and your deeds reflect the fact that you have heard Jesus' call and that you are committed to making sure that your life, everything that you are about, reflects his purposes, his agenda? If there is something contrary to what Jesus is saying to you, do you take the steps as quickly as you can to change your behavior in order to follow after Jesus? There are countless voices in this world, all vying for our attention. The voice of Jesus is not just one other voice that's trying to wake us up to the life that he calls us to know. As far as we are concerned, it is the only voice that matters. So if it requires us to say, no, sir, to the voices that are trying to move us in a direction contrary to the purposes of Jesus, we say no, sir, to those voices. In order to say yes, sir, to the voice of Jesus. For only by following the voice of Jesus will we get to the place and know the life that every single one of us is yearning to know. No, sir, to the world. And yes, sir, to Jesus. Barbara Brown Taylor is an Episcopal priest and one of the best preachers I have ever heard. I've often said to you, there are about five preachers that I'd walk across the street to hear. She is one of them. I have heard her on many an occasion. She's written a book titled The Preaching Life that I have found most helpful in my own preaching, my own homiletic. She tells a story that I could relate to. And any of you that have ever been to the Holy Land, maybe you can relate to this story too that Barbara Brown Taylor tells. A sight that if you are lucky enough, fortunate enough, you can see and take in, a sight that Jesus himself saw on so many occasions. She's speaking of how the Bedouins, who are the nomads that live in the Holy Land today, they are still to this day shepherds. And it's always exciting to me when I take a group to the Holy Land and we run across one of these Bedouin shepherds leading their flock. It's just like everybody moves to the side of the bus like they've never seen a shepherd and sheep. But the reason that they are so excited is because of stories like this. Oh my goodness, a shepherd and sheep, and they follow. But Barbara Brown Taylor says, you know, there is a time in the day when all of the shepherds in a particular locale, a particular vicinity, will bring all of their sheep to the same watering hole so that the sheep can get water. And it's not like Joe's sheep stays on this side of the watering hole and Bobby's sheep stays on the... All the sheep mix in together. And of course, sheep all look alike. So it's not like the shepherds can, when watering time is over and it's time to return home, it's not like the shepherds can go in and, well, here's your sheep and here's my sheep. What do? They all of the shepherds have a distinctive call. It may be a whistle. It may be a tune that they play on a reed pipe. It may be some other kind of vocal sound. But each shepherd has a distinct call, and as Barbara Brown Taylor reminds us, even to this day, every time the sheep leave the watering hole, the gospel is proclaimed. Those sheep, they all return to their shepherd. There's no possibility of sheep getting confused and going off with another flock. They will not listen to the voice of another. They know the voice of their shepherd, and their shepherd knows them, and they follow their shepherd and no one else. I think you see the application. I think you see the application. No, sir. No, ma'am. To those voices that are trying to move us with them in a direction contrary to the purposes of Jesus, in order that we can say yes, sir, to Jesus. And that is why, wherever you are in the course of your everyday experience, and whatever you may be doing, and whomever you are with, when Jesus calls, it is not poor etiquette, it is not inappropriate, it is a bold witness and a great expression of faith to say to all who are around you, excuse me, I got to take this call. I've got to take this call. Because it means hope, and it means joy, and it means life. And if you belong to Jesus, you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, if you're here this morning and you have no idea what I'm talking about, one day Jesus is going to call you. One day He's going to call you. And trust me, when Jesus calls, wherever, whatever, with whomever, you answer. Because of all the calls that could come your way, my brother, my sister, the call of Jesus is without question one call you cannot afford to miss.